Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say.
Good morning. Today is the day the Lord has made. We are going to rejoice and be glad in it. And as you walk your faith out into the world, one of the questions I want you to be asking yourself today is, you know, whose business am I about today? Whose business am I getting myself into? So this will probably not surprise you about me, but I tend to think that, you know, it's all my business. And so I'm constantly getting into what might be considered other people's business. And I do that because in the spirit of Jesus, I think that people are the Father's business. And I think he is intimately interested and has deployed us as ambassadors of his kingdom to speak his presence and his power into their lives, which means that I really never think that something's not my business. And so you might say to yourself, oh my goodness, that is... that she might be really hard to be around. Let me just tell you that as a person who likes to come up with very creative solutions to everyday practical problems, I find people tend to really appreciate when I stick my nose where other people might say it doesn't belong. And my inspiration for this comes from the fourth chapter of the Gospel of John, where Jesus encounters the woman of Samaria at the well. And, you know, he's into her business, man. He in sort of modern day parlance, we would say Jesus is reading her mail, and he is reading her mail in ways that would make one very, very uncomfortable. He is in her business, and she never says it's none of your business. And when the disciples get back and they have a conversation with him about, you know, food, which is just curious, right? It's just a curious question. Jesus is like, you know, no, I don't need the snacks that you brought from town. And they're like, what do you mean? I mean, aren't you hungry? And he's like, look, I've got food to eat that you don't know about. And the disciples are like, what? Did somebody bring him something to eat? And Jesus said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me, to accomplish his work. Jesus is about the Father's business. And if Jesus, who is our Lord and our Savior, is about the Father's business, then you and I are also about the Father's business. So the next time somebody says it's none of your business, you need to say, well, it's the business of the King, and I am here as his ambassador. So actually, it is my business. How can I help? I'm here to help. I'm here to listen. I'm here to bring the kingdom principles to bear. This is a family business matter because it matters to the Father, and so it matters to me. Bill English is going to be up next to talk with us about real life family businesses here and now. Maybe you have heard about the Purdue family of Purdue Pharma. They've got a family business that's in quite a lot of distress. Maybe you have always been intrigued by the Trump family and their business model. It's not uncommon for family members who work together in family businesses to have conflicts. Bill English and I are going to talk about the role of forgiveness and the importance of it up next here on Mornings with Carmen. Bill English, welcome back.
Hey, how are you today?
I am well, my friend. How are you today?
I'm just peachy.
Peachy. Our peach trees are budding. I bet that's not true yet in Minnesota.
We don't have peach trees in Minnesota.
I'm so sorry.
What?
I'm so sorry.
Except
I'm
maybe
so
ornamental ones. And even those are good.
Yeah, those are bad. But no, we really don't have much in the way of fruit trees up here other than apples, maybe. We have no orange trees, right? No peach trees?
No.
Plum? Do we have plum?
Yes.
Yes, we have plums.
Okay. Cherries?
Cherries.
We have cherries.
Do we have cherries?
They're not that good, but yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You know, cherries grow in like Washington State and in the UP of Michigan, so you're not too far north.
No, we're
I'm
not.
I'm just saying, but that's a geography conversation, which I'm not good at, so we should stop right there.
Well, should we? Well, you're the host, so you know, you tell us what to talk about.
Okay, well, what you and I are going to talk about today, Bill, is family businesses. And when family members get into conflict with one another in a family business, it's actually not unusual for them to end up at a level of conflict where they take each other to court. I have a friend named Bob Howard who lives in Wichita who was one of the attorneys for one of the Koch brothers when those Koch brothers took each other to court. And it was just this extended litigation because they could afford to just keep one another tied up in issues that really they should have been working out in other ways as a family. So let's talk about family businesses. Why don't you give us some examples of the kinds of conflicts that family members have when they work together in a family business?
Well, for example, up here in Minnesota, we had the Lund family. So the Lund family owns two grocery store chains. One is the Lund's chain. The other one is Byerly's. And one of the sisters back in the early 90s decided that she wanted out, wanted the rest of the family to buy her out. And so she asked for that. The rest of the family refused. And over the last, I'd say, you know, probably 15, 18 years, they have tried to do this amicably. Didn't work. They've ended up in court. It's now front page news whenever they are in court. They're now in the Minnesota Supreme Court. And that's just one example. I worked with a family of five siblings. One of them was managing a business in the way that the other four did not like. And so through a series of events, they forced that sibling out and forced an involuntary buyout of her stock. That did not go to court, but that did drive a wedge in the family that I'm not sure will ever be taken out. Another one, the dad did not like how the daughter was running the business that he had left her. So he took her to court and he sued her and he won. And she now owed him, I think at the time that I read this article, well over $200,000. It's a small business. It may have grossed only $250,000 a year. And so he effectively put his daughter out of business by suing her. So these are just some examples of what goes on in family businesses. I know of another where a brother and his wife cut off from the sister and the other brother because they had loaned the business a little over $200,000. This is an $18 million retail business. They had loaned the business over $200,000. The business fell on hard times, was not able to pay them back. So the brother and the wife just cut off. They just cut off and they moved to another part of the country. And they no longer talked to anybody in the family over a $200,000 loan. These things happen in family businesses, and they are heartbreaking to watch. They really are.
So we have some listeners who have texted a question and asked you and I to address a particular question. So I'm going to float it, and then you can decide whether or not we're going to address it now or later. Can you and Bill please talk about the challenges of working with our family members? What happens when family members are unequally yoked? I assume there they mean that that some family members are Christians and others are not. What does the Bible say about unequally yoked as business partners, and how can family members run a business as a business instead of being mixed up with personal things? I mean, I would say if you're mixed up with your family in business, it's personal. I don't think you could suss out those two things, could you?
Yeah, that's tough. And I think the unequally yoked passage assumes that you can make a decision to get into that relationship or get out of it. Right? With family, I don't think you have that decision necessarily. Your family is your family, right? You're born with them. And so, you know, if you have family members working in a business and some are Christians and some are not, I'm just going to say, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say from a theological perspective, I'm not sure the unequally yoked applies in the same way that it would apply, Carmen, if you and I were starting a business and I was not a Christian and you were, that would be a clear indication to you to not get into business with me. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
Right. So I think it's the agreeing on the principles of how we're going to run the business that maybe are the most important. Right. So I think that what you and I are probably talking about are questions of trust, you know, business practices that are going to be ethical based on biblical standards. And then I think that the other conversation that jumped to my mind was that, you know, sometimes family businesses include people who have married in, right? Who choices that have been made, and now people are in the family by someone's choice, but maybe not by everybody's choice. And so I think that it becomes very, very complex, particularly when we're talking generationally. So maybe we could talk about, let's take a quick break, Bill. And then when we come back, let's talk about how common it is for these family business disputes to end up in court, and then talk about the power of forgiveness.
Sure.
You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. My conversation partner is Bill English. You can find him at BibleandBusiness.com. We're talking about family businesses and what it looks like when we get into conflict. We'll be right back. So, Bill, let's take a step back and return to the conversation that we were having just before the break. Because what has come to my mind is, like, in the scriptures, we have the father with the two sons, the elder and the younger. The younger, you know, gets half of his inheritance. He gets half of the estate. And he, you know, basically says, I wish you guys were dead. So there's this, like, family divorce. But then he comes back. And the elder brother, who's faithfully been laboring alongside the father all along, you know, he's none too happy about the whole thing. What if in that story, although we don't have this, but what if in that story the elder brother actually has a wife? What do you think he's hearing about the family business and the righteousness of the return of the younger brother back into the business, into the fold, into the family, from, you know, from the person to whom he is now yoked, with whom he has now created a new little civilization of a family, but he's still in the family business of his father?
Yeah, he's probably hearing what he wants to hear from her because she's probably on his side and is wondering why the brother came back in the first place. In-laws are a big issue in family businesses, especially when they get married and then they are automatically given a job or a place of authority in the business. This is usually a mistake to make and it can also be avoided by simply, and I'm really speaking to all family businesses now, you really have to separate the family from the business. Participation in the family doesn't mean you get to participate in the business. And the business should have its own set of criteria for how people participate in it, whether they're family or not. Once you marry into the family, you're part of the family. Absolutely. You're at Thanksgiving, you're at Christmas, you're at Easter, you're at all the events. You are fully accepted and fully loved in the family. That doesn't mean that because you married the lucky DNA that you're now part of the ownership structure and the leadership structure in the business. And this is a mistake I see commonly made. It especially comes home to roost when there's a divorce. So daughter marries son-in-law. Son-in-law's made a VP of, you know, fun times, I guess, or something in the business. 3 years later, they're getting a divorce. Now what do they do? Now what does the family do with that? Because now the son-in-law probably has some stock, probably has a core key employee role, and now they're getting divorced. What do they do? That's a huge problem that can be avoided by having a better assessment barrier to people coming into the business when they join the family.
Okay, so that's one example of a dispute within a family business or within a family that is in business together. Are there some other common disputes that family businesses find themselves in?
Oftentimes about money. There's often dispute about money, how money should be spent. And there's usually huge disputes about roles. Now the roles here are, let's just take father-son, for example. Dad is the CEO. Son is the vice president of sales, for example. Son is half hour late to a staff meeting. And in the staff meeting, dad goes after son because he's a half hour late. And they're confusing their roles between father-son and employer-employee. Those often lead to significant conflicts in a business, is when you don't have good roles and people don't stay in their swim lanes.
Hmm. Let's talk about forgiveness.
Yep.
Because instead of taking, you know, a family member to court, it would seem to me that as Christians— and again, now I'm going to make some assumptions about my family members and the way in which we started our business together. Many of those assumptions may not be true. But if we're all Christians and we're also in business together as members of the same family, taking each other to court really seems ultimately destructive in the worst kind of way.
And it is.
So let's talk about forgiveness as alternative resolution.
Forgiveness is really the way that you apply justice in a family business, right? So forgiveness is saying, I'm going to live with the hurt and the pain that you caused me without trying to get back at you, without trying to get justice in the sense that justice would normally suggest. And so forgiveness is essential in a family business, because not only do you have family members who need to forgive each other just in the normal course of living together as family members, but now you have them also fulfilling roles in a business, and there's even more opportunity for mistakes, for wrong words, bad attitudes, things like that, that will need forgiveness. If you apply justice the way we do in America, you will eventually kill the family and kill the business if justice is just applied without prejudice. Forgiveness is the ointment that we use and that is needed to keep both the family and the business going.
So that's a great burden of responsibility for Christians who are in a family business where not everybody is operating by Christian principles. Because what I hear you saying is that as the Christian who is recognizing that there's a problem, there's a brokenness, there's been a deception, there's you know, there's been a misappropriation. I mean, on and on down the list of things that could be wrong. I have been wronged. I am going to suffer at least a financial loss, if not a reputational loss,
right,
simply by being in business, continuing to be in business with the members of my family. However, I am also in that relationship right now because I am a Christian and recognize it. I'm actually the stronger of the two oxes who are yoked together in this conversation.
Right.
And it's incumbent upon me, as an act of what we might describe as second mile love, to go the second mile, to exhibit forgiveness, even though I don't want to. I mean, it's really like grace embodied. And in business, that sounds like a hard thing to extend.
It is. It's a hard thing to extend no matter what happens, right? I mean, it's always hard to forgive. Forgiveness is not for the faint of heart. It's not easy stuff.
It's a cross, man.
It is. It's a cross that we bear. But forgiveness in business doesn't mean that we continue to accept poor performance, poor behavior, boorishness in the business, right? You still have your performance standards in a business, and if a family member isn't living up to that, then you fire them. Okay, you get rid of them, and you release them to go do whatever it is God has really called them to do. So forgiveness is not about accepting bad behavior. Forgiveness is about releasing that person to the justice of God rather than your own justice. And God's justice basically says this: if they confess their sins to me, God says, then the price is paid by Christ on the cross. If they don't confess their sins to me, then they will pay for those sins in the afterlife. That's really God's system of justice.
All right. So I hope that this has been helpful to you as you listen and as you walk your faith out into the world today. This is a reminder, I think, to each and every one of us that we are in relationships in the culture each and every day with people who are professing Christians, with whom we are hopefully walking stride for stride in the Spirit. We are also walking alongside people who believe they are Christians, but whose choices and their actions do not actually align with kingdom principles. And then we're walking with a lot of folks who are absolutely walking by the principles of this world. And they're not in any way, shape, or form suggesting that they're walking by the principles of Jesus. And so let's you and I, as Bill has encouraged us to do, be people who continue to operate out of the spirit of who Christ is, even when that means it is quite a cross to bear. Bill English from Bible and Business, thank you again for your wisdom today.
You are welcome, Carmen, and you have a great day.
Thank you. Friends, we're going to be right back. We're going to take a minute for Breakpoint. So we have talked today about apologetics. I don't know if you've known that that's what we're doing, but when we seek to bring the mind of Christ to bear on the headline news of the day, and when we talk about walking our faith out into the world in ways that honor Jesus, when we talk about being living demonstrations of the gospel, and when we talk about acknowledging that we need to be cooperating with the active work of the Holy Spirit within us, not only to bring our lives into greater conformity with who Christ is, but in order that our lives might be used of God to advance the gospel in the culture among people that he so loves. So that's when we talk about apologetics, we are not just talking about propositional ideas. We're talking about walking the faith out into the world. Joining me next is Paul Gould. He has written an excellent book entitled Cultural Apologetics. And cultural apologetics, from Paul's perspective, is about renewing the Christian voice, conscience, and imagination in a disenchanted world. We're going to talk about enchantment and the need for re-enchantment as you and I make the gospel winsome to the world in which we live. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. Hey, if you want to download today's podcast and share it with someone else, you can do that at myfaithradio.com. Paul Perreault very dutifully posts the audio from this show just a couple hours after we get off the air. And so if you've heard something today that you'd like to revisit, or you'd like to share today's show with someone else, we would invite you to do that. You go to myfaithradio.com, you click on the Mornings with Carmen tab, or you click on the podcast tab, either one, and you can find today's show or all of the shows that we air here on My Faith Radio, and you can listen to them again, or you can share them with someone with whom you think it would be a great encouragement. So again, that's at myfaithradio.com.
I know you already have plenty of weekly time commitments, but I've got one more thing to add to your plate. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Now, don't panic. This is a fun thing. I want you to find a place in your busy schedule once a week to meet with your child. It doesn't really matter what you do as long as it's one-on-one and it becomes a routine. You see, it's better to develop a relationship with your teen when the weather is quiet, because trying to establish a connection when there's conflict is like trying to hang wallpaper in the middle of a hurricane. It's time to add a new weekly event to your calendar. Invest in a relationship with your son or daughter before the turbulent years strike.
Parenting teens isn't for the faint of heart, which is why moms and dads turn to parenting expert Mark Gregston for help. Learn about Mark's upcoming events and check out his latest resources online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
So I am really excited to introduce Paul Gould. He's joining us via Skype, among other things. He's got a PhD from Purdue, so we should probably immediately say we're so sorry that Purdue is no longer in the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship.
Yes, thank you. We're still mourning here, even though we're in Texas. There's mourning.
That's exactly right. So, so Dr. Gould, you teach philosophy, you teach apologetics. And you are the founder and president of the Two Tasks Institute. I'm curious about that. You work with students and professors as a staff member, or you did at CREW, an organization that we love. You blog at paul-gould.com. And in my hands, I have the book, Cultural Apologetics, Renewing the Christian Voice, Conscience, and Imagination in a Disenchanted World. I am intrigued. Thank you so much for joining us today on Mornings with Carmen.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Carmen.
So when we talk about apologetics, I think that sometimes people glaze over and they imagine that we're going to have a really wonky conversation about reason and propositions. This book is not wonky, and you are not talking, although you were talking about truth and you are talking about propositional truth and things that are true, you're really talking about how do we winsomely and attractively communicate the mystery and the beauty and the wonder of the gospel in ways that actually engage people in the world today.
Yeah, that's right. One of the big burdens of even writing this book comes out of the last, I don't know, 2.5 decades of working as a campus minister and then a professor teaching. And really this question, you know, how does the gospel actually get a fair hearing in our culture today? Because the reality is there's, you know, there's kind of a public relations problem where people just don't think that Christianity is reasonable. And maybe even if they do think it's reasonable, they don't think it's desirable. And so I'm really trying to think about how can we have a more holistic approach so that the gospel will get a fair hearing, so that people can really ask for themselves, you know, this ultimate question, what do you make of Jesus Christ? So that's sort of the goal of the book.
Let's talk about this idea that we live in a world that is enchanted, although a lot of people experience it as disenchanted. What does that mean?
Yeah. So the idea there, you know, one of the questions that I'm exploring in the book is this question: what is the dominant way that modern Western culture perceives, thinks, and lives? And when it comes to this question of perception, you know, what is the dominant way of perceiving? In a word, it's disenchanted. And the idea there is that is basically that, you know, people use words like this. We say that the world is mundane, or we say that the world is everyday or ordinary. But in reality, that's actually not the way the world is, right? The world is deeply mysterious and it's deeply beautiful. And actually, to use the proper word, it's sacred, it's gift. And so part of our job as cultural apologists is how can we join with God and the Holy Spirit and each other really to re-enchant the world so that people will, and so this is the hope here, is that people will see and delight in the world the same way that Jesus does. And then as we do that, that we would invite others to do the same. And that will just help make Christianity and the gospel story, again, be more reasonable and desirable to people. It's part of that project of showing people that the gospel actually understands our hearts, you know, and it's true to the way the world is, but it's also true to the way the world ought to be as well.
So I think that as soon as we use the word enchanted or disenchanted, there are going to be people who their minds immediately move to the idea of magic. They're going to say, oh my goodness, Harry Potter now has two giant theme parks in Central Florida. How could you possibly begin to imagine? I mean, we've got all kinds of television shows. We've got a rise of paganism. We've heard about all kinds of new groups of witches and Wiccans and on and on and on. What do you mean we don't live in a culture that is, you know, spiritually charged up and where people are interested in intersecting with the unseen realms? But what you distinguish is the unseen realms that we ought to be engaging with and ought to be celebrating and those that we ought to be avoiding.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up. What's so interesting about this is you know, the modern intelligentsia, they say that there is nothing beyond this mundane world. You know, the material world is all there is. But it's interesting, if you look at the kinds of things that we're drawn to as humans, you know, and the kinds of shows we watch, the amusement parks we go to, you know, the things that we're interested in, it's almost as if our longings betray us because we long for something extra mundane. And that's partly the obsession with, you know, Marvel universes and DC universes. And of course, for me, it would be more Narnia or Middle Earth. For others, it's you know, Hogwarts, but so false reenchantment is possible, and that's in fact one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, the danger of these false reenchantments, and paganism is one, this obsession with the occult is as well, and so you're right, we want to be careful to point them in the correct way, but real quick, here's here's how I view enchantment, reenchantment. And actually, the thing that unlocked it for me was C.S. Lewis in a not well-known essay called Talking About Bicycles. And I'll do this really quick, but he says, with respect to bicycles, and he's using that as an example of pretty much everything, we go through four stages. He says we enter the world as an infant, you know, we see the world of adult gadgets and we're unenchanted toward them. That's the first stage. And then he says, you know, that moment when the training wheels come off as a young child and suddenly you're riding that bike for the first time freely, all is as it should be. And that's the second stage, which is enchanted. The world is as it ought to be. And then he says we go pretty quickly to that third stage, which is disenchanted, where the bike, with respect to the bike, it becomes work and grueling. And I can relate to that as a child. And Lewis says that we need to press through that. He says most of us stay in that third stage, but we have to press through that to the fourth stage, which is reenchantment. And what he means with that, with respect to the bike, is that we would begin to enjoy it in creaturely response as gift. And that's the kind of reenchantment that I'm speaking of here, that we would see everything as gift from God, that we would enjoy it in creaturely response, and then invite others, you know, into that same divine drama.
So I'm going to continue my conversation in just a moment with Dr. Paul Gould. He's the author of Cultural Apologetics, Renewing the Christian Voice, Conscience, and Imagination in a Disenchanted World. When we come back, we're going to talk about home and a longing for home, and actually living as people who embody the gospel in such a way that other people would understand that this is not ultimately our home, but there is one not made by hands toward which we are moving even now. So that's up next in my conversation with Paul Gould here on Mornings with Carmen.
When I'm up, when I'm down, when the wolves come around, when my feet hit the ground, I just need...
So here on Mornings with Carmen, we frequently talk about the reality that we are sent by God as ambassadors of his kingdom and the principles of his kingdom out into the world. And we cannot really communicate the gospel in non-gospel ways. If we're going to communicate the gospel, then we have to embody it. We have to be beautiful living demonstrations of the gospel. When Paul Gould talks about that same concept in cultural apologetics, he's talking about an embodied apologetic. What does it look like for a Christian to walk the faith out into the world in such a way that other people would be drawn? Like there's a winsome, I'm going to use the word winsome, that people would be drawn toward us, and that would provide the opportunity for relationship and conversation. Paul, I love the tone of this, and I love that you set our sights on home. So talk about this embodied apologetic, this having to live it out idea, and then let's move to a conversation about the last chapter, which is home.
Okay. Yeah, the embodied part. And so, you know, in writing cultural apologetics, the thing that I realized, and there's a longer story here, but there's objections to the faith. You know, often when you talk about apologetics, most people think about, as you said earlier, you know, giving arguments. And of course, as a philosopher, I love to give arguments, but, you know, propositional truths and things like that. And rightly so, because Christianity is under attack as unreasonable. But that's not the only objection out there in our culture. For others, they might think that Christianity is reasonable, but it's just not desirable. And it could be because Christians are hypocrites, or, you know, because we live fragmented lives and so on, or a whole host of reasons. And so in cultural apologetics, I'm talking about how can we show the beauty and the truth of the gospel in such a way that actually enfolds it into what it means to be human, that we're rational animals, but we're more than that, that we're desiring animals, we're imaginative animals, we're moral animals. And of course, the gospel speaks to all of that. And so the idea is that we would give an apologetic that understands how we make culture and that we're shaped by culture as humans. And so that's the first part about embodying a little bit. And then in terms of home, this idea is really a fertile idea, because the more that I teach philosophy and I sort of enter into the narrative or kind of the Western canon of literature that shapes the Western world, the ancients believed that reality literally was a story. And so, for example, Augustine thought that that story begins with God, and then there's this wandering from God, and then there's this turning point where we return to God. And if you read Augustine's story of his own journey to faith, it was just exactly that. It was one of wander and then return. And a lot of the medievals and the ancients thought that reality was structured in that way of wander and return to God. And of course, as you think of the Bible, one way to think of that overall narrative of the Bible is in the same way, that it begins with home, you know, God creating this perfect place where humans can be genuinely happy. And then, of course, early on, we're away, Genesis 3. And really, from Genesis 3 to the end of the story, it's a story of God bringing us back home again. So you could think of the overall narrative of Scripture even with four words: home, away, and home again. And so I think this idea of home is one of the most important metaphors for life. You know, all of us live in a home. It might not be an ideal home. But I think deep in our hearts, we have this picture of, you know, home is the place where we belong. It's the place where we know we're known and we're present and we belong. And that, I think, often I think of Blaise Pascal, who was an Enlightenment thinker, where he says, you know, deep within the human heart, there's this memory of a time when man was truly happy, capital H happy. And what he's talking about there, this memory of Eden. And I think that's really the journey that we're all on, is that we long for home. We long to be with God. And so our job as cultural apologists is to reawaken this longing and set people back on that journey to the deepest longing of their heart for home.
So I think that's beautiful. And I, you know, I have had the experience of being with Christians who, when they start talking about heaven, and mm-hmm. by that they mean home, you know, the ultimate home, I mean, their eyes grow wet. Their heart is pounding in their chest. There is a longing. And right. I think that when the Apostle Paul talks about, you know, to that he'd be happy to go at any time, but that God, you know, kept him here for, you know, for God's own good purpose. And, you know, to live as Christ and to die as gain, because you get more Christ, right? You get full access immediately. I really, I appreciate that that's where you land at the end of this book, because I do think that, that is a little bit lost, among much of sort of the thinking church today, this longing for home. And, I think I see the longing for home more in, and I want to be gentle here in the way that I say this, but among Christians who maybe don't all have Ivy League educations, right? Among a population of people, particularly across rural America, who they long for home in ways that the intelligentsia among Christendom just doesn't. And it's interesting. It's an interesting dynamic. I'm so glad that that's where you landed. We have a couple of minutes left. What I would love for you to do, Paul, is unpack. I'm actually looking in the appendix at page 221, because that's where you list it so succinctly, recalling this broad outline of Paul's methodology of this cultural apologetic at Mars Hill. Can you just run through that little fourfold outline?
Okay. Yeah, so the whole book finds its inspiration from Paul's encounter with the Greeks on Mars Hill. And what's interesting about that, so Paul is engaged in a culture unlike his own. And so the first thing that he does there is he walks around and he examines the culture. It literally says in Acts 17, verse 22 and 23, that he walked around and examined carefully, you know, over and over again, the culture, so that he could build a bridge. So that's the first thing he does, is understand our culture, and we should as well understand our Athens. Secondly, though, he notices all around Athens these altars to the unknown God. And he uses those as a starting point from which to build a bridge to Jesus and the gospel. And so in my book, I unpack four starting points that we can use, these universal longings that every human being has for goodness, truth, and beauty. Third, though, what Paul does, as you look at his speech, is he sets out a case for Jesus. And he does this brilliantly, outflanking their thinking. He addressing barriers along the way. He quotes, you know, from their own poets and their own philosophers, and that's great for us to think about as well. And then finally, though, what he does beautifully at the end is he brings them to the ultimate question, you know, what do you make of Jesus Christ? And he does so in a way that they actually understand. And so that's basically the fourfold model that I unpack on our book. How can we have a conversation with our Athens, like Paul, and build bridges through the plank of reason, the plank of conscience, the plank of the imagination, addressing barriers along the way, so that Jesus and the gospel will be viewed as true and beautiful and good?
Paul Gould, I hope this is only the beginning of a conversation about cultural apologetics. I hope that this is the kind of apologetics that really sort of catches fire in the imagination of the church today, in order that we as Christians might just more faithfully walk the faith out into the world, in not only in ways that honor Jesus, but in ways that communicate him faithfully to others, that people would make of him what he truly is, the Son of the living God.
Yeah. Thank you, Carmen. It's great to be with you this morning.
Thanks so much. Hey, you guys can check out what Paul's doing at paul-gould.com. The book is Cultural Apologetics. I'll be right back. So as we close out our time together today, let us consider what it means for us to be cultural apologists. And so today, wherever you're headed, maybe you're headed into work, maybe you are headed into school, maybe you are staying in today, in which case your cultural apologetics might be over social media and through prayer. Let me encourage you to be making the most of Christ in your own life, allowing him to take every thought captive by the power of the Holy Spirit, bringing you into greater conformity with Christ, right? In order that as we encounter the world and as we encounter the questions of the world, we can be doing so in the Spirit of the living God. Right? The world does not need another piece of our mind. They just don't. I can trust me. People don't need another piece of my mind for sure. But what they do need, what each of us needs, is the peace of the mind of Christ. So how are we going to deliver that to them? That's the challenge. That's the opportunity. That's the goal of the day. Now get out there and do it. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.